It is Survivor Series Sunday, November 20th, 2011. And this is episode 191 of the Solomonster Sounds Off on SEScoops.com. I am the Solomonster. Thank you, as always, for downloading the show. Really appreciate it. Big day here for WWE Survivor Series at Madison Square Garden. I, myself, will be attending the event later tonight, along with other members of the SE Scoops family, Webmaster Mike, Noah the Mark himself will be there, among others. So, should be a fun time. I'm really looking forward to being there. It's always more fun to go to the show live than it is to watch on TV, and even when the product maybe isn't so hot. At least when you go live, all the pomp and circumstance, the pyro and the entrances, and just the people in general, it's always a good time. So, looking forward to it. Maybe I'll even see some of you there. Looking forward to that as well. So, with that out of the way, we got a couple of things to get to here. We're going to run right through this because I got to get ready to head out for the show. And we're going to talk about Raw. We're going to talk about all that stuff. But I'd be remiss if I did not start out by mentioning that we're also going to have the very first installment of Match Anatomy on this show. This is the segment that I've been talking about for several weeks now, where you guys would submit match choices to me, classic matches that could be classically good, classically bad, for me to watch and review. Could be a match from recently, could be a match from many years ago. And I got a lot of submissions from you guys. So many that I'm probably backlogged for now, so you don't necessarily have to keep sending them in, although you can if you want to. I've chosen a match. I think I might have mentioned Goldberg versus Hogan from Nitro might be a match I pick. I actually ended up going with Bill Goldberg and Raven from WCW Monday Nitro back in 98. We'll do that a little bit later on before the mailbag segment. Watched it. Wasn't a long match, so it's my my kind of match when it comes to these types of segments here. Not very long. But I'll get to that. That's coming up a little bit later on, so that's something to look forward to. Let's start with some Survivor Series predictions here. Let's run down the card for tonight's pay-per-view, and I'll give my thoughts on each match here. And as of right now, there's only one traditional Survivor Series elimination match scheduled on this show. It's Team Orton against Team Barrett. Team Orton, of course, led by the Viper, Randy Orton, teaming up with Sheamus, Mason Ryan, Kofi Kingston, and Sin Cara against the team of Wade Barrett, Intercontinental Champion Cody Rhodes, Dolph Ziggler replacing the injured Christian, Jack Swagger, and Hunico. So that's your elimination match at the Survivor Series here. Right off the bat, my pick would be Team Orton. What combination of them will survive, I have no idea. Obviously, Randy Orton, I would expect, will be part of the winning troop, if not the sole survivor of that match. Although I could see Randy Orton and Sheamus standing tall at the end of this match. I don't expect Team Barrett to win. It's one of these matches where, at the end of the day, there's really nothing on the line. It's a match, I think, that serves to further some feuds that are ongoing right now. It's just kind of filler, actually, in a way. There's not a whole lot riding on this match. It's just a bunch of guys that they wanted to get onto the card, and they slap them together in a 5-on-5 match, which should be entertaining enough, but it really is a match of no consequence. I'll go with Team Orton in this match. We have Beth Phoenix defending the Divas Championship in a Lumberjack, or I guess this would be a Lumberjill match, against Eve Torres. The Divas title is on the line. I would expect Beth Phoenix to escape with the championship, retain her title. At least I hope she does. We also have a U.S. title match that's been signed. Dolph Ziggler's pulling double duty on this pay-per-view because he is that damn good. Ziggler's going to put his U.S. title on the line against John Morrison. This is an interesting situation in that Morrison, as I understand it, has not necessarily re-signed with WWE. It's possible that he has, but all signs continue to point to him possibly leaving the company within the next couple of weeks. And why they would then put him on pay-per-view in a U.S. title match if he wasn't signed, that doesn't make a lot of sense, which tells me that he probably has signed, but I keep hearing otherwise, so who knows. I was very disappointed when I heard that Morrison was getting the title shot. For multiple reasons, obviously he's been treated like a jobber over the last couple of months. Up until recently, he hadn't won a match in over 3 months. All of a sudden, he gets a title match on pay-per-view. It just goes to show you that titles really don't mean anything in this company, that a guy who lost every single match he was in for months on end can now be eligible for a U.S. title opportunity. But beyond that, you know, Zack Ryder has been engaged in a feud with Ziggler now for many weeks. And Ryder has been building support. He's been building a coalition. He's had this petition for a U.S. championship match that thousands have signed so far. And they've incorporated it into a storyline now with John Laurinaitis involved, and he has to have a certain number of signatures in order to get a title shot, and now he doesn't, so therefore Morrison got the shot instead of Ryder. You know, originally I thought it would be Zack Ryder getting the U.S. title match. At least that's what everybody seemed to think. And it would have been something for him to get that title match and win, even though the championship doesn't mean much. For Zack Ryder to have a match on pay-per-view and win a title in Madison Square Garden in New York, yes, it's not Long Island, but it's close enough, would have blew the roof off the place. And they put Morrison in there instead. Here's what I predict. I predict that at the end of the day, Zack Ryder is going to walk out of Madison Square Garden the new U.S. champ. I have to believe that they're going to do some sort of angle, perhaps pre-match, where Ryder comes out and claims he has enough signatures on the petition, gets added to the match, maybe makes it a triple threat. Perhaps maybe the match between Morrison and Ziggler goes on as planned, and maybe it happens after the match is over. I just have this feeling in my gut that tells me that Zack Ryder is going to get a U.S. title match at Survivor Series, and if he does, we'll probably walk out with the championship. At least, I hope so. So, that's my prediction. I'll go out on a limb and predict that. I'm predicting that a guy that isn't even on the card is going to not only win, but win a championship. World Heavyweight Championship on the line. Mark Henry defending against The Big Show. Battle of the Big Men. Last time these two men were in the ring together, the ring collapsed. I don't think we'll see the same thing at Survivor Series. It would kind of suck for The Rock to have his first match back in 8 years in a broken ring. I like what they've done with Big Show and Mark Henry. Big Show is a guy that you can take seriously. Big Show can be all comedy and smiles, and you know, he comes down to the ring and he's waving at people and he's the jolly old giant. When you piss him off, he gets really angry. And you can believe that this is a guy that can just tear your head off. And when he cuts promos, he does it in... His promos are great because you can relate to them. It's almost conversational. It doesn't sound like the same scripted, rehearsed stuff. He's a veteran. He knows what he's doing. I like Big Show. Now, that being said, I don't think Big Show needs to be the World Heavyweight Champion. If you remember, the last time Survivor Series came to Madison Square Garden was back in 2002, almost a decade ago. And I felt the same way then as I did now about Big Show. In that particular instance, Brock Lesnar was the WWE champion. Big Show was getting a title shot. And Brock Lesnar, up to that point, had been undefeated in WWE on television. He was managed by Paul Heyman, and that was the night that Heyman turned on Lesnar and sided with Big Show, helped Big Show beat Brock to become the new champion. And I felt that at that time, that was the wrong decision to make. Brock was still a heel at that time, but when he came into Madison Square Garden, clearly that was a Brock Lesnar crowd. And he was throwing Big Show around the ring like nobody's business. I mean, like nobody had ever thrown Big Show around before. He was giving him belly-to-belly suplexes, and he gave him an F5, which, even all these years later, looks as impressive now as it did then. So I thought Big Show winning the title and being the first person to beat Brock, probably not the wisest move to make. And I have to say, I feel the same way now in 2011. Big Show being the man to stop Mark Henry in his tracks, being the first person to stop Mark Henry and win the championship from him, I think would hurt Mark Henry. Mark Henry has to lose at some point. I don't think this is the right time for that. Now, what do you do? Do you have Mark Henry beat Big Show clean? Probably not. I mean, I would do it, but I say probably not just because I don't think WWE would do it. You know, Mark Henry beat Big Show clean is a sheet of Money in the Bank. To do it again, it's expecting too much out of them. I just can't see them doing it. I've gotten questions recently asking me, where is Kane? What's happened to Kane? He's been off TV for months. Is he coming back? And as I said to this person in response, I would not be surprised at all to see Kane come back at the Survivor Series and, you know, what role he would play. Perhaps, you know, Mark Henry is about to do some serious damage to Big Show's ankle or something to that effect, and Kane comes out to make the save. Because at some point, this Mark Henry-Big Show thing has to stop, and Mark Henry has to move on to somebody else. Big Show is one of those guys he put out with an injury. Big Show came back to avenge the injury. Kane is another guy that Mark Henry put out with an injury. You would expect that at some point, Kane's going to come back and probably have at least one, if not more than one, pay-per-view match against Mark Henry. Not a whole lot of time to do that between now and WrestleMania. And God, I love Kane, but I do not need to see Kane and Mark Henry at WrestleMania. So, with time running short, Kane should be back probably any day now. And what better place for him to make his return than in the Garden at Survivor Series, perhaps coming to Big Show's aid. And that could lead to a Kane-Mark Henry title match at the TLC pay-per-view next month. Now, Kane could just as easily not come back. He's ready to come back. They're holding him out. Perhaps they hold him out until the Royal Rumble. you know, as a surprise entrant in the Rumble match. That's entirely possible too. But these are my predictions. I'm going to predict that Mark Henry will retain the championship. I'm not going to make a match winner prediction here because perhaps Big Show wins by DQ or something like that. But I'm going to predict that Mark Henry keeps his title, and we see the return of Kane at the Survivor Series. That brings us to the other championship match of the night. CM Punk will challenge Alberto Del Rio for the WWE Championship. This is a feud that, God bless Punk, Punk's great, but I'm not feeling this whole Punk-Del Rio thing. It's probably more Del Rio than it is Punk, but it's really brought him down, you know, from where he was just a couple of months ago. Which is a weird thing because, you know, here's CM Punk fighting for the WWE Championship, supposedly the most prestigious title in the company, although I'll argue that the World Heavyweight title is now the most prestigious title in the company. You know, Punk's in a big-time match at Survivor Series fighting for the title. It just doesn't feel special to me. And it's not because The Rock is overshadowing everybody else. That's only part of it. The way this feud has been booked, it's put me to sleep. I mean, I find myself completely bored by all of this stuff. You know, Laurinaitis is involved. Obviously, John Laurinaitis does not want CM Punk to win. You know, he's basically told Del Rio, we can't allow Punk to win. It would be disastrous for Raw. It would be a disaster for the WWE. You know, what the finish is here, who knows? I just don't see Punk winning the championship yet. I think at some point he will. For him to walk out of Madison Square Garden, the champion, wouldn't shock me, but I'm going to predict that Alberto Del Rio will retain the WWE Championship. CM Punk will not walk out of Madison Square Garden with the title. That's my prediction. And that brings us to the main event. Tag team match. Miz and R-Truth against The Rock and John Cena. This is, of course, The Rock's first wrestling match since WrestleMania 20 in this very building, Madison Square Garden, back in 2004. That was a match that, ironically, Rock was also part of a tag team that night, and his tag team lost. It was The Rock and Mick Foley against Ric Flair, Randy Orton, and Batista from Evolution. If I remember correctly, I believe Orton pinned Foley in that match. And, you know, you look back on it, and it's kind of an anticlimactic way for The Rock's in-ring career to come to an end. For a lot of years, it looked like that might be the way that it comes to an end. And Rock is going to come back. It's his first match since WrestleMania 20. He made his in-ring debut on television in that same building at this very same pay-per-view, the Survivor Series, in 1996 with that wacky, god-awful hairdo. I don't know what he was thinking back then. But The Rock won that night. I think he might have actually been the sole survivor for his team, if I remember correctly. And so in a way, 15 years later, The Rock has now come full circle. He's back where it all started for him in one of the, you know, most legendary buildings that one could possibly make his return in. I'm sure The Rock is going to be getting a hero's welcome in New York. The New York crowds can sometimes be a little fickle. You don't know how they're going to react. But to me, they won't react in any sort of negative way to The Rock. Now, the same cannot be said for John Cena. I fully expect Cena to be booed out of the building. This is going to be more like WrestleMania 28, like a WrestleMania preview on a much smaller scale. Instead of having a stadium with 75,000 people, you'll have a building with 20,000. But this right here, I think, is going to show you what John Cena has in store for himself in Miami at WrestleMania. Just a small sample, I think, of what we have in store for him. And I think that, here's the thing with The Rock, okay? The way that they have booked this whole thing with Rock coming back to be Cena's partner because The Miz and R-Truth have to be stopped, okay? Does anybody for a second actually take The Miz and R-Truth seriously as a threat? Of course not. And they could have tried to make them a threat. I still probably would have found it tough because The Miz, I can only take him so seriously. The way I would have booked the lead-up to this match, either on the go-home show or the week before, whatever week it was, you had to have at least one really hardcore, brutal beatdown of John Cena and or The Rock. As a matter of fact, I wouldn't have left The Rock and John Cena standing on Raw this past Monday night. And I'll get to Raw in a little bit. I don't want to dive too much into that. This whole feud was missing that. You know, to want The Rock and John Cena to join forces to beat up these two guys, you have to believe that these two guys are either a threat or they've done something so heinous. The Rock hates John Cena so much that he's willing to put aside that hatred and actually be his tag team partner because, for example, maybe Miz and R-Truth laid a beating on him with a lead pipe in Boston last Monday. Left The Rock, I mean, I would say leave The Rock bloodied, but obviously there's no blood. But any number of scenarios would have been better than what they went with. So essentially, they're banking on people buying this pay-per-view because it's The Rock's return. And what's the next chapter in the feud between John Cena and The Rock? And we'll see how the show does. You know, maybe the show does double what it did last year, and it doesn't matter. To me, it doesn't matter what the show does. If the show does great, it could have been even better than great. And if the show does poorly, then they have nobody to blame but themselves. Now, as somebody who's actually going to the show and has a ticket to the show, I'm excited to see The Rock. I'll admit, you know, to me, the real selling point of this pay-per-view is The Rock. It's the comeback of The Rock. It's him making that entrance, the crowd going nuts, seeing The Rock in the ring for the first time in 8 years. It's special. Even John Cena. It's always fun to be in the Garden when the crowd turns on him. I'll never forget at the Rumble when he was that surprise entrant back in 08, and he made his comeback. He was number 30. He won the whole thing. When he came out, the place went nuts for him. As soon as his music stopped and he hit the ring and actually started wrestling, and I think he was beating up Mark Henry, the place realized, huh, why are we cheering this guy? We hate him. And they started booing him. And they would not let up for the entire time. It's always entertaining to see that. So as somebody going to the show, I think I'm going to have a lot more fun watching this show in person than probably many of you will on pay-per-view. Maybe I'm wrong. Maybe this show turns out to be great. Money in the Bank in July, which I don't remember on paper it being any sort of tremendous show. Money in the Bank was one of the best pay-per-views WWE ever produced. And that main event will live on for years to come. It is possible for WWE to put on a tremendous pay-per-view when they want to. The stars have to align. And perhaps at the Garden tonight, the stars will align. But I'm looking forward to the show. I'm optimistic. I am very optimistic on this show. I think it'll be good, and we'll see what happens. Now, as far as a prediction in the main event, I'm going to go with Miz and R-Truth. Not that it's going to mean a goddamn thing to their careers, but I think you have to continue to build tension between Rock and Cena. You can't just have Rock and Cena. I could easily see them doing this, and this would just infuriate me to no end. If they have, let's say, Rock gives Miz a rock bottom, and or people's elbow at the same time that Cena has R-Truth trapped in the STF, or perhaps Cena executes an attitude adjustment and they do a double pin where Rock and Cena beat both of them at the same time, and then they have this stare down at the end of the pay-per-view. That would suck, okay? I don't want to see that. I think you can have Miz and R-Truth steal a win in this match and build heat between Rock and Cena, have a pull-apart, have them go at it at the end of the show in a real pull-apart brawl, like really intense. I believe Rock can do it. I don't know that I have faith in John Cena to do that. Have a bunch of referees come down, John Laurinaitis comes down, try to break them up and separate them, and you can go off the air like that. These guys are just, they're beating up the referees, they're going after each other, they tumble out of the ring to the floor. You can end the show like that. There is one other scenario that they could go with. I don't think this is going to happen. In fact, I know this is not going to happen, but I'm just sitting here thinking about this. If ever there was a time that you could turn John Cena heel, and they're not going to do it. But if there was ever a time for you to do it, this is it. Just imagine. Just imagine for a moment, if you will, the reaction, the rabid reaction from the fans. If as the match is about to come to an end, The Rock has The Miz beat, or he has R-Truth beat, has him in the middle of the ring, getting ready for the people's elbow, takes the elbow pad off, chucks it into the crowd, and perhaps up to this point, something happened, you know, the referee took a bump, he's down. There's a chair laying in the ring on the apron that Miz tried to bring in. Rock bounces off the ropes, comes off the ropes, leaps over Miz, hits the ropes on the other side, and as he comes off, John Cena is there to greet The Rock with a chair shot to the skull. Protected, of course. Just imagine the reaction that that one spot would get. And then, of course, Miz and R-Truth can steal a win. Granted, it's a cheap victory, but it's a victory nonetheless. And you make the heel turn you official. You know, you take a chance. No more of this, let's straddle the line. You either turn him heel or you don't. So if you were going to turn him heel, I might do it that way. You know, then you can have Cena lay into him after the match with some more chair shots and just kind of hold his arms out, and I'm sure he would be showered with debris. And it would change the dynamic of WrestleMania in that instead of it being face versus face, choose your side, it's now clearly a babyface versus heel match, and the babyface, unfortunately, is a person who's probably not going to be around much after WrestleMania. That's the only problem here. John Cena is going to still be here. The Rock won't be. So, that's the problem you run into. But there's money to be made with John Cena as a heel. But you have to have that one other really strong babyface to kind of replace The Rock when he leaves. CM Punk could be that person, although I know he probably, you know, he wants to turn heel to get that match with Steve Austin at WrestleMania, which I don't think is going to happen. But there's a lot that goes into that. I'm just saying, if I were booking and if I actually wanted to turn John Cena heel, that's the way to do it, you know? And he beats Rock so badly with a chair that it gives Rock an excuse to not be back on TV for another 2 or 3 months. Then you can have Rock come back at the Royal Rumble, perhaps. You know, Cena will probably be in the Rumble. Rock maybe is in there as well, and they eliminate each other. Maybe Rock comes back from, you know, his injuries at the Elimination Chamber and goes after Cena. Then you have a solid month plus leading up to WrestleMania where The Rock is available, and you can really build this thing up between the two of them. But in the absence of a heel turn, which, like I said, is probably a million-to-one shot, you just have to somehow find a way to continue that bad blood between the two of them without making it so obvious where they just beat Miz and Truth clean and you just go off the air that way. I mean, to me, that would be an underwhelming finish to the pay-per-view. So they better have something smart up their sleeve if they want to really drive interest in this match. I don't have a lot of faith that they can do this because they haven't really given me a lot to be hopeful for since Money in the Bank. We'll see what happens. You know, we'll see what they got up their sleeve. That's how I would do it, but perhaps they have another idea. Let's go back and talk about Raw from last Monday night. We have to talk about Raw because Raw was a three-hour show last Monday, and these three-hour shows are insufferable, generally speaking, and this one was even worse because of all the Twitter talk, which I'll get to in a second. So on this show, we have The Rock and Mick Foley, both making returns. Same Mick Foley who WWE fans last saw on TV 3 years ago. It's like a lifetime. One of the biggest stars in the company's history. And he just shows up, coming out of a car backstage. But really, I mean, his return was the worst-kept secret in wrestling, and he actually technically already returned on the recent UK tour. So it's not like they were making a big deal out of it anyway. I just thought it could have been more special. The big news here is that the Rock and Cena actually laid out Miz and R-Truth to end the show. I just got done talking about that, and that's exactly what they did on Raw Monday night. Which is why I think they can't do the same thing at the Survivor Series for a finish. But, you know, much the same way John Cena laid both guys out by himself a couple of weeks ago, here we have the babyfaces laying out the heels. And we never did get that one big great beatdown of the babyfaces. So it's this new style of wrestling booking here in 2011. They're banking on the fact that Rock wrestling for the first time in almost 8 years is going to be the big pay-per-view draw, and everything else is inconsequential. I happen to disagree with this way of thinking, but since I don't get paid the big bucks, I'll let them run their company however they see fit. That said, I paid good money for my ticket to Survivor Series, and like I said, I'm optimistic. Even after that show Monday night, I'm optimistic that in spite of all the bullshit we may have seen on Raw Monday night, they've got something good in store for us at the pay-per-view. So the other thing also is Jonah Hill is next week's guest star on Raw. His new movie actually looks really funny. But he's not because he's not fat anymore. It's the only thing he had going for him. Because you see, fat people are generally funnier than skinny people. Myself being the exception, of course. Let's talk about the good on this show, shall we? We had Cody Rhodes ditching the face mask. He came out without it. I'm sure it will take its rightful place in the Hall of Fame one day right next to Bob Orton's cast and D'Lo Brown's chest protector. But it's a good move here. Long overdue. He did not need that mask. He does not need the bags. He just needs to be himself, and he needs to cut normal promos. That's the other thing. He needs to stop speaking the way that he's been speaking, and then Cody Rhodes will be on his way. I mentioned that both Rock and Mick Foley made returns on the show, but to me, the biggest return of all, overshadowing both of them, was the return of Bull Buchanan. Yes, John Cena's former running mate, B Squared, made his return for one night only on this show. I called it, by the way, the second that Foley announced the This Is Your Life segment, so I'm very proud of myself. Speaking of John Cena, This Is Your Life. This was a bad segment, don't get me wrong. It failed on so many levels. You know, for example, it was clearly designed to try to turn John Cena's hometown fans in his favor, and it didn't work. And think about that for a second. The fact that they have to work so hard to get Cena's hometown, I know he's from West Newbury, but still, he's from the New England area. The fact that they have to work so hard just to get his hometown fans to cheer him, I've never heard of such a thing. The best part of this segment, though, the reason I'm putting this part in the good category, the best part of this was John Cena Sr. Johnny Fabulous, who actually does indie work in the New England area. John Cena's father does do indie work. He did a phenomenal job insulting the crowd and getting his son booed even more. I popped huge for this and was highly entertained. Once the old man got booted away, I was very sad. You know, the guy also takes a mean punt kick, too, as he did from Randy Orton many years back, so he can bump better than his son, too, and he cuts better promos. And then we have The Rock. He was very good without doing much on this show. Not that it was his best performance or anything, because it wasn't, but he brings a level of intensity and energy to the show that Raw is just sorely lacking. The contrast between him and Cena is just remarkable. On the one hand, you've got a guy who you can actually take seriously. You know, when Rock comes out there, he does his own comedy and he gets laughs. And I wasn't very happy with all of his Twitter talk either, but he knows when to flip that switch. You know, when he starts to breathe heavily and he starts eyeballing the other guy across the ring, you can really believe that he's about to beat the ever-loving shit out of that other person. And then you got John Cena, who has his own awful brand of comedy, but you can never take him seriously, no matter what. You know, nothing seems to faze this guy. Nothing bothers him, whether he loses matches, he loses championships. The main event of WrestleMania, he loses, he gets beaten down by Nexus. To him, it's just no big deal. You know, he's always smiling or smirking or winking or shrugging his shoulders, and, you know, that's why people boo him. I mean, I remember when he destroyed Michael Tarver of Nexus on Raw, and it was brutal. It was as brutal an attack that we've seen from John Cena. I mean, I don't think we've ever seen quite an intense Cena beatdown of somebody before, if you go back and watch that segment. It's like something actually got to him, and he reacted. And the fans were into it. So it is possible, but his only argument is that The Rock talks via satellite, you know, and he's got no other material. They script nothing else for him. WWE gives him nothing to work with. By the way, Rock was standing in the ring when he made that satellite crack again on Monday. That doesn't work when the guy is, you know, standing right next to you. That's just a little FYI for the future there for WWE. Then we have the bad. What was the point of the Michael Cole challenge? I'm still trying to figure this out now, 5 days later. I mean, just to get JR to dance and get weight on national TV? Good one, Vince. Good one. Joke's on him, I guess, though, because JR's dance routine actually got the second biggest pop of the night behind The Rock, and his 239 pounds on the scale is actually far lighter than he used to be. He's not even really that much heavier than Cole, if you think about it. Cole clocked in at a pudgy 200 pounds. But to drag this thing out for several weeks the way they did, with seemingly no real purpose, just to screw the fans over yet again. I mean, you've got CM Punk out there saying everything that we believe. You know, Punk came out and basically did a work shoot, if you think about it. He came out and he said that Michael Cole, you suck. Jim Ross is the best announcer, you know, and he's better at you than at his job. All of these things that people clearly agree with, and yet they still kick JR out, and they have Michael Cole announce the show. It just, I don't get it. I did find it funny that Richard Reed from our Facebook page, I want to give him credit here, said that during this segment, his three-year-old daughter actually said, "Daddy, are those guys going to wrestle?" And when he said no, she asked, "Then why are they in the ring?" It's kind of like when Cousin Sal's son, Archie, on the Jimmy Kimmel Show, who's a six-year-old, mind you, if you remember this, he predicted that Rey Mysterio was going to win the title from Miz on Raw that time, and John Cena would then get the title back from Rey Mysterio, and lo and behold, that's exactly what happened. You know, these kids are smarter than the people who write these freaking TV shows. I really would love for them to let kids write one episode of Raw and just put it on TV. Like, I really think the show has a chance of being better than what we see every week and making more sense. I really do. I'm not just saying that to be funny. Just do a one-week experiment. I mean, it's already a PG show. Just put the kids in charge. Mason Ryan nearly killed poor Dolph Ziggler on the show on a Uranage slam, and all I could think was, what does this guy have going for him, other than the fact that he's big? He's got no real personality. I mean, at least none that we've been allowed to see. I mean, when they first turned him babyface, if you remember on this very podcast, I proposed the idea that perhaps you have him make some appearances on Zack Ryder's internet show. You know, maybe start shadowing him around the TV as well. Maybe he's got something, but nope, he has nothing. He sucks in the ring. He can barely move around because of his musculature. You know, he's so cut and so big and so heavy it affects his movement. He just looks naturally clumsy. And the fans are completely apathetic towards this guy. When he comes to the ring, they just could care less. They could not possibly care any less. It's just the question. I mean, am I missing something here? What does he have that I'm not seeing besides the fact that he's big? He's like the Warlord of 2011. And guess what? The Warlord sucked too. CM Punk is losing steam fast. I alluded to this a little bit earlier on when I did my predictions. You know, you watch Raw Monday night, you just think to yourself, he has to win the title at this pay-per-view tonight. He has to, even though I don't think he will. But he's been beaten down and beaten down and beaten down and beaten down. And you know, yes, his promo on Michael Cole at the beginning of the show was good and certainly truthful, but it makes him look bad to put an announcer in his signature submission hold in the Anaconda Vice and have the announcer come right back out less than an hour later. I mean, I know Cole was trying to sell it and he had his arm in a makeshift sling, but, you know, any other time in wrestling history, if an announcer, a non-athletic announcer at that, got put in a submission hold by one of your top stars, that guy wouldn't show his face probably for weeks. But at the very least, he would miss the rest of the show. But nope, Michael Cole came out later on, and he was fine. You know, he announced the show. He wasn't complaining about being in too much agony or anything like that. I mean, you couldn't keep Cole off the show to sell it for one night. You had Jim Ross there, and you just couldn't help yourself. You just had to kick Jim Ross off and bring him back out. Really? Really? Remember, Punk also hasn't won a pay-per-view match since SummerSlam. Or Money in the Bank, really, if you don't want to count that fluke win at SummerSlam. So he really needs some momentum here. I mean, he's better than this. And logic, which doesn't apply here, but logic would dictate that he keeps getting beat and keeps getting beat. He's got to win the championship. And I just don't think it's going to happen at the Survivor Series. I just don't. Rock and Cena arguing at the end of the show and beating up Miz and R-Truth like a couple of jobbers was, well, it was an interesting way to hype Survivor Series. What more can you really say? You know, as I said, the buy rate's going to determine whether or not this was the right move to make. And, well, actually, you know what? That's not true. It was the wrong move to make. I don't care what the buy rate says. But the buy rate, let me rephrase that, will determine whether or not it ultimately mattered. Or if the idea of Rock's in-ring return being enough to convince a couple of 100,000 extra people to buy the show worked. I guess we'll find out. And the ugly part of this show. It was so nice when they were in the UK the week before and not live, and therefore couldn't get things to trend on Twitter. But this on Monday night was just sad. I mean, it's really, really embarrassing. It's not a true barometer of what's popular, first and foremost, so at least if it actually meant something, I could see the point of doing it. But it means absolutely nothing. It means nothing when you trend on Twitter. And I happen to like Twitter, personally. I find it useful for certain things and entertaining in other ways. But I think we can safely say that Twitter is the worst thing to happen to pro wrestling since the What chant. I mean, pushes have been derailed because of it. Legacies of some of the biggest names in the business have been tarnished because of it. Kurt Angle's account alone has apparently been hacked more times than body parts in a Friday the 13th movie. I mean, what else can account for some of the comments that he's made over the last several months? I'm over this Twitter nonsense, and from what I understand, it's only going to get worse, even at the Survivor Series, which thankfully I won't have to listen to the commentary. But for all you poor saps that have to, apparently get ready for even more Twitter talk on the pay-per-view this weekend. Lucky you. And now it's time for the debut of a new segment on this show. It will not be every week. In fact, I don't even know what the schedule is going to be. It'll be as time permits. We're going to call it Match Anatomy. And basically what you can do is you can send in your requests, any sort of good match, bad match, whatever promotion it may be from over the years. Could be recent, could be 25 years old. Anything you'd like for me to watch and review here on the show, kind of pick it apart, analyze it, give the backstory behind it, give my thoughts on it, as entertaining as you might find that to be, you can send those requests in to me at thesolomonster@gmail.com. It's the best way to do it. If you submit this stuff on Twitter and Facebook, I probably will forget about it, quite frankly. I like keeping them all in one place, and email is the best way to organize all these match picks. So you can email me there. First match we're going to do here, which I got one or two requests for, and then I watched it. I hadn't seen the match in many years, and I realized that this match here is one of the reasons that I love pro wrestling so much. It was a U.S. title match on WCW Monday Nitro. The date was April 20th, 1998. It was the night after WCW's Spring Stampede pay-per-view. And at that pay-per-view, Raven, who was getting a push at the time in WCW, he had his own faction called Raven's Flock that had people like Sick Boy and Reese and Billy Kidman, among others. Raven had beaten Diamond Dallas Page at the pay-per-view to become the new WCW U.S. champion. And at the same time, Bill Goldberg was an up-and-coming star in WCW. He was building this undefeated streak. He was about 74-0 at this point. I believe he beat Saturn at the Spring Stampede pay-per-view the night before. So fast forward to Nitro the next night, and Bill Goldberg is now in line for his first title opportunity in World Championship Wrestling. He's going to challenge Raven for the U.S. title. One of two title matches on this show, by the way. They were also promoting a WCW Heavyweight Championship match between the Macho Man Randy Savage and Hollywood Hulk Hogan, probably the 358th match of their career. But Goldberg versus Raven was fresh. It was a match we had never seen before between two guys who, I guess Raven was still relatively young at the time, and Goldberg was probably already in his early to mid-30s, but he was on fire. He was easily the top star in WCW at that point. He was catching fire. He would get even bigger at that point. But Goldberg was on this hot undefeated streak, and he didn't have very many matches that went long. I mean, he had matches that had gone 8, 9, 10 minutes, but usually not much longer than that, which shielded and hid whatever weaknesses he had. That's one of those things that Paul Heyman in the original ECW was so good at, is that he could take a guy who may not have been that good, and whether it was giving him a new character or it was just putting him in the ring just in kind of small doses in limited quantities, maybe he was a big guy, you know, who could do an impressive chokeslam or something. So he would send a guy like 911 in there to chokeslam people, and guys got over because of it. Unlike WWE's mentality, which is apparently, if you watch their shows, we're going to take your weakness and exploit it and make sure that you don't get over and make sure that you don't become a big star. At the time, you know, people like Paul Heyman were able to hide that sort of stuff. Raven was a talented guy, but you can make the same argument about Raven, and that's why Raven got over so well in ECW. I mean, think about what Raven was doing on TV before that. He was in WWE as a manager and an announcer named Johnny Polo, going nowhere. So anyway, the point of all this is that Bill Goldberg is really the only true star that WCW ever made during the Monday Night Wars. You know, there were people like Sting, who many, many, many years earlier became stars, although when Sting became a star, it was still the NWA. But you go back to those mid to late 90 years in WCW, they did not make hardly any stars. Bill Goldberg was one of, I'm trying to think of another one other than Goldberg, there must have been another one, I guess maybe DDP, but Goldberg was the one true bona fide star that they made. And they did a hell of a job with him, up until the point that they didn't, but we're not here to talk about that. So Goldberg comes out for this match, and actually before I even get to that, one of the things I liked about this was the fact that they made the match feel special. This is something you don't see a lot these days. I mean, you're talking about essentially a mid-card match. Even though Goldberg is probably one of the hottest acts in the entire company, he's still fighting for the U.S. title against Raven. It's not the main event of the show. And they took the time to actually air these pre-match segments. Goldberg didn't speak. They would show him backstage. He was snorting. He was spitting. He was getting himself all revved up for this match. They showed Raven sitting down in the corner of a shower somewhere in the bowels of the building, talking about the fact that he was not going to be victim number 75. He was next. You know, Goldberg used to say, "Who's next?" Raven said, "I'm next, but you're not going to beat me." And he said, quote, "The Raven, nevermore." And they had a couple of these promos. So they actually aired these things to help build the match. You don't see that these days. The only thing you get is the traditional opening segment of Raw or Impact or whatever, and you get 20 minutes of talking that leads to a main event. And all I could ever think with those segments is, why do they go through the trouble every single week of not bothering to have a main event already lined up when they go on TV live? It's kind of dumb. But they did a hell of a job promoting this match. And then they had Michael Buffer. Michael Buffer was there to do the ring introductions for the main event. He did it for this match as well. He said, "Let's get ready to rumble," and out came Raven. And I'm watching this, and I'm looking at this crowd. They've got, I don't know how many people were in the building. It probably was somewhere between 10 and 15,000 people. Again, this was around that time of WCW's peak. You know, 1998 was the peak of that company. And really, in early 99, they began that slow descent down to the depths of hell. So you had a lot of people in this building, and people were excited. I mean, you had people with signs. You had people jumping up and down. You had a lot of teenage boys in the crowd. I mean, the audience makeup was very different than it is today. And Raven came out to the ring, and it just had this big match feel to it. And then Goldberg came out. Obviously, he got a big reaction. Raven laid the title down at his feet, challenged Goldberg to come at him head-to-head, and Raven went right after him, you know, and it was a short match. I mean, the match all told probably didn't go more than 6 or 7 minutes. You know, Raven would get a couple of spots in there, and Goldberg would fight back. I think he even showed off a new move, as Tony Schiavone said in the course of this match. He gave some sort of spinning back kick, which actually was kind of similar to the kick that ended Bret Hart's career. This might have been that kick. So I guess the kick that ended Bret Hart's career first debuted in this match against Raven. And anyway, Goldberg threw Raven outside. Or actually, I think it was Raven, I'm sorry, who threw Goldberg outside. Went to throw him into the barricade back when they used to use the actual heavy metal barricades and not the black padded ones they do now. The dasher boards, if you will. And Goldberg reversed it, whipped Raven as hard as he could. And back then, when you had those metal barricades, the thing I used to love about them was you throw somebody into those barricades, that barricade ain't going to hold. It's going to go back. And if you're in the front row, you better watch your knees. You better watch your ass. It looked brutal. And Goldberg threw him into the railing again on a different side. He was beating the hell out of this man outside the ring. And at that point, the announcers made it a point to mention the fact that this match was being contested under Raven's rules, which basically meant there were no rules. It was a no-DQ match. There must be a winner. The Flock actually had front row seats. They were at ringside sitting in the crowd. Raven introduced a chair at this point in the match. He was going after Goldberg with a chair, put him in the ring, and this is where things got good. And there's a moment in this match that just... you talk about a crowd reaction. And I've had people email me questions for the mailbag over the years. What's the biggest pop you've ever heard? I probably even covered it on the show. And there have been some big pops. I mean, CM Punk in Chicago this year at Money in the Bank is a tough one to top. Steve Austin coming out of Backlash 2000 when he was in the Rock's corner and beating 6 people up with a steel chair just 3 months after neck surgery. That was a big pop. I mean, I could go through a whole list of these things. But you watch this match... And there's a moment where Raven is beating on Goldberg. He's throwing him from one corner to the other. Now he's punching him, and Goldberg is just shaking it off. I mean, this just does not have any effect on him at all. And Raven doesn't know what to do, and the crowd is just building. It's building, and it's building. And Raven hits the ropes and comes off and gets caught with a wicked spear by Goldberg. I mean, Goldberg just spears this poor bastard out of his boots. And the crowd in unison, if you're watching the audience, those first 5, 6, 7 rows, everybody at the same time leaps up out of their seat and just roars. I mean, Tony Schiavone even says on commentary, he said the crowd erupts, the fans erupt. And that's exactly what it was. It was an eruption. And it made me a little bit sad watching this just because I don't know that we're ever going to see this again. I mean, you watch a typical episode of Raw, and this was Nitro. I mean, this wasn't a pay-per-view. This was a live Nitro. I think it was a 3-hour show. But it was a live Nitro. And the people were reacting to this like this match was the end-all be-all here. You know, they were invested in this match. They wanted Goldberg so badly to beat this guy and win the championship. And when he speared Raven out of his boots, it's one of the biggest pops I've ever seen. I say seen because it wasn't just heard. You're watching these people jump up out of their seats. It's so exciting. So then, of course, the Flock gets involved. Almost immediately after getting up, Goldberg gets caught by a top rope drop kick by Sick Boy. Kidman comes into the ring. Sick Boy, is on all fours and does the thing where Kidman leaps off his back at Goldberg, which was really dumb. Goldberg catches him. He almost drops him and botches the whole thing. But Goldberg... He was a strong motherfucker, this guy was, and he was also a little bit reckless, and he tossed Kidman over his own head and over the top rope to the floor like he was a sack of potatoes, like he was just nothing, and he clotheslined Sick Boy out of the ring, and then Horace Hogan comes in, Hulk Hogan's cousin. What a waste of space he was in WCW. He comes in with a stop sign and just slams Goldberg right in the head, right in the skull with the stop sign. It made a great noise. And, of course, like an idiot, he turns around to pose and laugh. And then when he turns back around, Goldberg shakes it off and spears him down for good measure. And then in comes Reese. Now, Reese was a guy who was probably a legit 7 feet plus. He might have been 7'1", something like that. He was a big dude. And the only exaggeration, really, on commentary that I had a problem with was Tony Schiavone at one point said that Reese weighed over 500 pounds, which I won't say is impossible. I would say that it's highly unlikely. He probably should have said something to the effect of, that man is over 400 pounds. But it was a minor nitpick. The reason I even mentioned that is because the commentary in this match was also really good. For all the people that rag on Tony Schiavone, and well-deserved, Schiavone and Larry Zbysko during this match, and Mike Tenay as well. You know, Mike Tenay was on commentary too. They did a hell of a job in this match. And maybe it's just the fact that the announcing now is so goddamn horrible that it makes Mike Tenay, Larry Zbysko, and Tony Schiavone sound that much better. But they were great in this match. So anyway, Reese comes in, picks up Goldberg by the throat. Goldberg headbutts him. So, of course, Reese drops him. And Goldberg goes to deliver a jackhammer to this guy. And again, you look at the crowd, and they are in awe. They just cannot wait to see if Goldberg can pick this dude up. And he does. Goldberg was a strong guy. He gets Reese up. He didn't hold him up there for too long, but just getting him up was impressive enough, and he gives him the jackhammer. The place at this point is unglued. I mean, the place is going nuts. Raven, meanwhile, had tried to escape by going through the crowd, and they had a couple of guys planted in the crowd. They pretended they were fans. But it was a cool visual because they all ganged up on Raven and threw him back over the barricade to the ringside area. So, of course, on commentary, the announcers were saying, well, the fans threw Raven back. They wouldn't let him leave. As if. So then Raven comes back in the ring, gets speared for his troubles one more time. Goldberg gives the signal, picks him up. Jackhammer, 1-2-3, match over. And it doesn't seem like much, and I know there's some Goldberg haters out there. Nobody will ever claim that Bill Goldberg was a great wrestler, but at his peak, or as he ascended to his peak, as that streak built and built and built in 1998, and he went 75-0 on the show, Goldberg was the man in WCW. He really was. I mean, the people were into him, and he won the U.S. title, went 75-0, and it was a tremendous match. It really was. And you wouldn't necessarily think it. I mean, Goldberg versus Raven, you know, in the middle of a Nitro show from 98, but it really was. And if you've never seen the match before, I would advise you to go on YouTube, as I did, and watch it. There's a YouTube video, the one that I watched, which is probably the best one for you to watch, actually has, it's really good quality, but it also has the pre-match vignettes that I talked about leading up to the match, not just the match. It's about a 12-minute long video. Seek it out and watch it. It's just great stuff. It's what pro wrestling is all about. I mean, pro wrestling is about a lot of different things to a lot of different people. Some people don't like this bullshit. Some people only like Japanese wrestling. Some people only like Lucha Libre. Some people only like the technical style of wrestling. And if you can't wrestle like Eddie Guerrero and Chris Benoit and Kurt Angle, then you suck. And other people have a little bit more of an open mind. They like all sorts of pro wrestling. You know, they like all that stuff. They like Chikara. They like Ring of Honor. They like the Independents. This was an example of one of the reasons I love pro wrestling so much. And even if wrestling died tomorrow, it would still be around for a long time, and I would still enjoy it because of all these videos and all these great matches. It allows you to look back on the way things used to be. And like I said, it could also be very depressing because I wish I could turn on Raw one week and the fans would be so into the show and so into, you know, John Cena and Alberto Del Rio, for example, that they would react to it the way that these fans reacted to this match in 98. It's not going to happen, but for a few minutes, it takes you back in time. Goldberg versus Raven, I think, is one of those matches that doesn't get enough credit. People like to think of Goldberg versus Hogan, which I was gonna review that, and I still might. And I probably would have said the same thing about Goldberg versus Hogan, because that match also, in a much bigger building, you had 40,000 people in the arena for that match. And Hogan is obviously a much bigger star. Did the job that night for Goldberg, whatever his ulterior motives might have been. That was a great moment, too. That was the peak of Bill Goldberg that night. But this match against Raven, I mean, you just have to see that first spear in this match when the fans erupt. I mean, it's just incredible. So, anyway, that's Goldberg vs. Raven from Nitro in 98. So for those of you who suggested it, I thank you. I very much enjoyed myself. And if you have suggestions, again, for matches that you'd like me to review and kind of a trip down memory lane here on the show, email me at thesolomonster@gmail.com. All one word, thesolomonster@gmail.com. The same applies, by the way, for the mailbag, which we're going to get to here in a second. If you have any questions, comments, or anything like that, you could email me there. And before we get to the mailbag, I did want to mention one thing here. A quick plug for a good friend, George Napolitano, the wrestling author, historian, photographer, great guy, who I interviewed, by the way, on episode 182 of The Sound Off. For those of you who may have missed that, you can go back and listen to that. It was an hour-long interview. Great, great stuff with George. We talked about his new book, Hot Shots and High Spots, and he's actually going to be having a book signing this upcoming Tuesday, November 22nd, in Brooklyn, New York. It'll be at Boulevard Books on 76th Street and 13th Avenue in Brooklyn from 7 p.m. to 9 p.m. There'll be a Q&A as well. Bushwhacker Luke is going to be there as well. So if you're a Bushwhacker fan, you might enjoy that. So those of you who would like to perhaps meet George for the first time, see Bushwhacker Luke, partake in some Q&A, tell George what a great interview he did with me. No, I'm just kidding. And on a serious note, if you haven't read his book, and it's not really a book to read, it's more of a photo book. There are some really cool stories in there. And I'm not just saying this because I, you know, did the interview with him and I consider him a friend. It's a great fucking book. I got my copy as a comp, but I gladly would have paid for it. So this is an opportunity for you perhaps to also pick up a copy of his book. Just wanted to put it out there. He'll be doing that signing on Tuesday, so if you can make it, definitely do so. And if you do make it, email me and let me know what happens. So let's get into some of your mailbag questions here before we wrap things up, episode 191. First, I got a quick birthday shout-out here for Rob. Turned 16 on November 16th. He's been a fan of the show since episode 145, so happy birthday to Rob. Seth from Citrus Heights, California writes in, longtime listener, huge fan. His question, he says, may seem somewhat useless, but it's important to him. And it's this. He is confused and perplexed at the seemingly foreign sounds that some wrestlers make when wrestling. Two specific examples come to mind. Hulk Hogan and Mick Foley. In Hogan's case, he usually notices it when he's training someone. Before the collar and elbow tie-up, he'll give the traditional self-shoulder slaps. And then when locking up, he makes a sound like, shia, shia. In Foley's case, his noise is more like, oita, oita, usually upon hitting his opponent. I hope I did a good job, by the way, of saying those noises. He says, please forgive me for my weak attempt to spell out these atrocious noises. Is there a reason they do this? Not to be confused by the Viking's more enunciated huss, huss sound that he would make when grabbing his wrist while cupping his hand. I believe the Viking you're referring to is the Berserker. Now, from his WWE days, anyway. But I love this question just because I wonder the same thing myself. Those exact noises that you mentioned, I've noticed them too, especially in Foley's case. When Foley used to, especially during the Mankind days, you know, when Foley used to be beating up somebody and he would start ripping out chunks of his own hair, you know, back when he was doing that gimmick, and he would make those, you know, hoitay, hoitay noises. And I'm like, what the hell is he saying? Where is this coming from? It's like some sort of, you know, belly cry or something like that. It's just part of their shtick, really. I mean, I don't think there's any particular reason for it. If there is, I certainly don't know what it is. I'm more than happy to tell you I really don't have an answer to your question, but I'm with you. I've heard the same noises. Hogan, too. I think Hogan was doing that a lot also during his match with The Rock at WrestleMania 18. You know, he would make those noises whenever he would deliver a punch. He would be like, shia, shia. And I just think it's just something that they probably have done their whole career, maybe without even realizing it, quite frankly. You know, Lex Luger is another example. Talk about atrocious noises. Lex Luger was probably the noisiest wrestler I've ever seen, certainly the noisiest main eventer, because this guy could not take a blow or deliver one without shouting. He would always scream. So, for example, if somebody gave him a chop or if somebody gave him a punch, he would just shout. He would be like, ah! And this would happen all the time. I think even when he delivered certain moves, Luger would always scream. Go back and watch any old Lex Luger matches or narcissist Lex Luger matches or anything like that, and you'll see what I'm talking about. Kelly, by the way, is also pretty goddamn noisy. She's kind of annoying. Definitely hot, but very annoying. She screams all the time, too. I guess she's a screamer, so make of that what you will. Sean from Northwest Indiana writes in. He's part of the Triple Threat, minus iTunes. He's been a listener for a couple of years now. He says, your show makes the drive to work much more enjoyable. Thanks for what you do. Well, thank you for that. His question is as follows. He's watching Impact this week and realized that most of the TNA guys have recently got new entrance music. AJ Styles, James Storm, Bobby Roode, Abyss, Jeff Hardy. All the songs sound similar, and I really had no clue who was coming out when they would interrupt in a promo segment. AJ Styles, for example, when he interrupted James Storm this week, I had no idea who it was until they showed him walking to the ring. James Storm has his quote at the start of his, but after that it sounds like generic jobber rock songs like the other ones with new songs. The theme songs have always been a big part of someone's character to identify them. Why would they do this to so many guys at once and make them all sound alike? Their storylines have been confusing enough. We don't need everyone's music sounding the same so everyone blends in together. Look at what happened to Dolph Ziggler and his hair many months ago. That's a really good point, actually, about Dolph. Thank God they came to their senses with him. I remember that, too. They made him dye his hair from blonde to brown, and they made him cut it. And I just remember, you know, he just was a dead ringer for Ted DiBiase to me. He just looked like everybody else, and thankfully they let him go back to his old hair color and his old hairstyle. But as far as the TNA theme music is concerned, I think he hit the nail right on the head. I mean, theme music is something that people can use to differentiate themselves from everybody else. You want it to sound different, and I have not heard all of the new theme music that you've referenced. I did know, for example, that Jeff Hardy got a new song and all that, but if that's the case, then I agree. That's just terrible. And I've always thought that TNA's theme music was kind of weak. There were a few exceptions. I was a fan, for example, of Beer Money's theme, and I will admit that Jeff Hardy's old theme music, the one that he used as a heel, I have actually warmed up to that music quite a bit. I actually liked Jeff Hardy's old theme before he, I guess, just got a new one. But theme music is very important. Even in WWE, to be honest with you, there's a lot of great theme songs, but you know, theme music now, to me, it just isn't what it used to be. I think the golden period for theme music, if you think about it, was probably, at least in WWE now I'm talking about, you know, the early 90s or the mid-90s. And I'm not saying the theme music was great, but, you know, you'd have Henry Godwin, for example, who was in the news recently, unfortunately. You know, his theme music was, for all intents and purposes, aside from the strumming of a banjo or whatever the hell it was a bunch of pigs oinking. You know, Duke the Dumpster Drozzy was the, you know, the garbage truck sound, and you know, T.L. Hopper was the flushing of a toilet. Really corny stuff, but you would identify people with their theme song. You know what I mean? The Honky Tonk Man sung his own song. Shawn Michaels sung his own song and ended up using it for the entire length of his career. Matt writes in, "What's the worst wrestling injury you've ever seen? Also, do you know what the situation was in terms of WWE banning the pile driver, aside from it being an obviously dangerous move? When was it officially banned, and was there one incident in particular that led to it?" The worst wrestling injury I've ever seen, as I mentioned to Matt here in my email back to him, would probably be Sid breaking his leg in WCW. Just absolutely gruesome stuff. Draws getting paralyzed at the Nassau Coliseum here in New York back in 99 was worse for obvious reasons, but I wasn't actually there, thankfully, to see it. As far as the pile driver is concerned, that ban, the time period for the ban was 2001-2002. Actually, I take that back. It was 2000-2001. It was somewhere in that period. I believe Undertaker dropped Triple H on his head for real during his run-in. Remember that Judgment Day 2000 main event? It was Rock versus Triple H in the 60-minute Iron Man match, and Undertaker made his surprise return, his first appearance as the American Badass, and their time cues were all screwed up. They were just rushing to get that finish in at the end before the clock ran out, which it did anyway. And I believe Undertaker may have dropped Triple H on his neck for real. Triple H may have suffered a bit of a neck injury. And the ban would have gone into effect not long after that. And Undertaker started using the Last Ride Powerbomb in place of the Tombstone, which he did go back to using. I think Undertaker and Kane really are the only guys that have carte blanche in terms of using that move. But that would have been when it happened. There was some sort of angle, I recall, from Raw, which may have been after that, although it may have also been in the year 2000, where Val Venus gave China a pile driver. This might have been when Val was part of the Right to Censor. So that, again, would have been in the 2000-2001 time frame. And they made a very big deal about it. And that was the last time I can recall a normal pile driver being used on WWE television. Actually, I take that back. It might have been Steve Austin and Kurt Angle in September of 2001, around the time they were feuding for the championship when Austin was heel in the Alliance. He actually delivered a pile driver to Kurt Angle on the exposed concrete on the outside. Kurt Angle, of all people, he gave a pile driver to on the floor. That probably would have been the last time I can remember seeing someone execute a regular pile driver on WWE TV. Last question here comes from Lude, and it concerns the Montreal Screwjob, which will not die. He recently had a discussion, he says, with a friend about the validity of the Screwjob. And his friend did a pretty good job putting doubt in his mind about whether or not it was a work. Now, before you delete this email, hear me out. His points were, with Vince knowing what was about to go down, why would he choose to show the aftermath on live television? He could have easily cut the pay-per-view feed short instead of having footage air of Brett destroying the set, spitting in his face, and spelling out WCW to the crowd. Okay, I'm going to take this point by point here. So before we get to the second point, first of all, what you just said is wrong. It's absolutely incorrect. I know that over the years, they've shown footage numerous times of Brett spitting in Vince's face and Brett finger painting the letters WCW in the air and taking the monitors and smashing them. That did not air on pay-per-view. The pay-per-view did go off the air prematurely. I remember it because I was pissed when it did. I think the pay-per-view, back then the pay-per-views aired from 7 p.m. to 10 p.m. Eastern time. And instead of 8 to 11 like they do now. And if I remember correctly, that show went off the air at around 9:37. I actually remember this. It's one of those, you know, do you remember where you were when this happened moments? It was about 9:37, which even by WWE standards, it's pretty freaking early to go off the air for a pay-per-view. So they did go off the air early. They did not show Brett. They showed Brett spitting in Vince's face, but I think the shot you're referring to, where they actually zoom in on Vince's face and you can see the spit all over his face and everything, that they didn't show. They did show Vince hawking, getting caught by that magic loogie. I will admit that. But the stuff with him finger-painting WCW and smashing the set and everything else, that did not air on pay-per-view. In fact, I think the first time it aired was probably a year or two later. WWE on USA, they had some sort of Survivor Series special they were promoting. And to try to get ratings, I think they were promoting the fact that we're going to have footage of never-before-seen footage of Montreal. At the very least, I know they had it on one of their home videos, because I still have the VHS tape here somewhere. And they made such a big deal about it, you know, exclusive bonus footage, never-before-seen. And, you know, it was kind of a cop-out. They just wanted to try to make some money off it and whatever. But that did not air on pay-per-view, so that would be incorrect. Second point, why did Vince have to come to the ring to signal for Earl Hebner to ring the bell? If the plan was to screw Brett before the match started, why would Vince need to show up on screen to make the call in front of a live crowd? Has Vince McMahon, the businessman, the promoter, ever done such a thing? In terms of a match, no, because typically Vince McMahon was announcing. And he did not announce on this show for obvious reasons. He had a lot more on his mind than, you know, what was going to... You know, being an announcer, I think, was not the primary concern of his on that particular evening. But it's also important to keep in mind that this feud between Brett and Shawn, in a lot of ways, was real, but they tried to make it seem even more real than it was. And Vince McMahon was already entrenched in this feud. I mean, Vince McMahon got in a fight with Bret Hart on Raw a couple of months earlier. He got into a scuffle with him in Ottawa when Brett came to the ring to confront him about Shawn Michaels being made the referee for his title match at SummerSlam, and then he grabbed Vince, and Vince grabbed Brett's shirt. Remember, he pulled Brett's shirt over his head, and they went back and forth. And Vince was already part of this whole scenario. By this point, everybody knew he was the promoter, and you know, Shawn would reference it, and Brett would reference it. So he was very much part of this whole thing. And the idea behind having Vince there was to make it feel more real and to make it feel more unpredictable. Like Vince needed to have a seat at ringside. There was one point where Brett and Shawn are fighting up the aisleway, and there's Vince. You know, there's a shot of Brett looking over at Vince. Vince is trying to tell him, you know, stop this, get back in the ring. It was all part of the match. It was all part of the, the whole gimmick for the match. But part of it also was that Vince wanted to be at ringside when the shit went down post match. You know, I've read where maybe Vince promised Shawn that he would be there at ringside because, you know, Shawn was obviously very worried. And if you pay attention, there was a lot more security at ringside than you would normally find. And Vince wasn't the only one there. Vince had Sergeant Slaughter with him. Slaughter was known as a shooter, so there was a good reason to have him there as well. The fact that Vince was out there doesn't mean anything. He could have been backstage. He could have been in hiding. To me, that doesn't really fit Vince's personality. I can't see Vince McMahon backstage hiding, although I guess he kind of did after the match was over. There's that scene in Wrestling with Shadows where Brett... claims that Vince locked himself in his office or something, although Vince did come out and he ended up confronting Brett and got knocked out for his troubles, but that doesn't prove anything. Last part of his email here, The idea that the Montreal screwjob was a work, and the plan was for Brett to leave the company for a payday and ultimately return for a huge angle with Vince, which was put to rest by the Goldberg incident. All of this is starting to make sense. Would Vince McMahon really put himself in the middle of such a nasty situation on live TV? The answer is yes, by the way. Especially when he didn't have to. On top of that, would he really allow Brett to have a personal camera crew backstage on a night that he knew beforehand would be the most controversial night in company history? Something does not add up. What do you think? I mentioned George Napolitano's name a little while ago. If you go back and remember the interview I did with George, because George was at ringside for that match, which was one of the questions I just had to ask him. You know, what were you thinking? What was going through your mind that night? He was on the hard camera, too. You could see him snapping pictures at ringside for that match. And he, on this very show, on the Sound Off, he said the same thing. You know, he said that it was unheard of for Vince McMahon to allow access like that, to allow someone else's camera into his locker room. And so, not that George was saying he thought it was a work, but he was making the same argument that perhaps it could be, and that would be one of the primary reasons. And I will grant you that it was not something that Vince went out of his way to do for many other people. In fact, I don't remember ever hearing about Vince allowing something like that for anybody else. But Paul Jay was following Brett around with that camera long before Montreal. In fact, he was filming for almost a year. I guess the idea being, he was filming a year in the career of Bret Hart. And it's always been a little fishy in my mind, too, that it kind of climaxes in the best possible way. I mean, you could not have scripted a better ending for that documentary than what they got. I admit that. Very fishy. But to me, it was a coincidence. It worked out to their advantage, but that does not mean it was a work. Not at all, in fact. The footage in the documentary of Vince McMahon after he got punched, walking through the hall, it's not as though Vince knew, or Gerald Briscoe, who was with him, they didn't know the camera was on. You know, when Owen Hart comes walking by a little bit later on, he knows the camera's right on him, and he says, please turn it off, I don't want to be filmed. Is it bizarre? Yes, because it's not the sort of thing that Vince McMahon does, even today. I mean, they're very controlling. You don't need me to tell you how controlling the people in this company seem to be. But it doesn't prove anything. It doesn't mean it was a work. It just makes you think a little bit. And all the other arguments that your friend made, they don't hold water to me. Especially the stuff about how, you know, that the show would have gone off the air early. It did. You know, they wouldn't have showed Brett destroying equipment. They didn't. They wouldn't show Brett finger-painting WCW. They didn't. That did not air on the original pay-per-view. Years later, they used that footage to their advantage to make money and to bump ratings. Okay? Because they film everything. I mean, that was going to be on camera no matter what. I'm sure somewhere in their vault, they've got footage of Owen Hart falling from the ceiling, which is not something any of us ever have to see. Hopefully, it'll stay under lock and key. But there's always a camera running when it comes to these TVs and pay-per-views, whether it's something that airs on TV or not. You know, that doesn't mean anything, and it doesn't prove anything either. So I would tell your friend he might want to watch Jesse Ventura's conspiracy show. He might actually enjoy that. He sounds like the kind of person who perhaps would enjoy a good conspiracy TV show, because I don't really believe there was a conspiracy here. That's going to do it for the mailbag this week. If you have questions, you can email me at thesolomonster@gmail.com. Thesolomonster. Don't forget the word the. Very important. Otherwise, some poor sap named Solomonster is going to be very pissed off at you if you email him. You can follow me on Twitter at twitter.com/Solomonster. And you might want to follow me on there this weekend here, because as I make the trek over to Madison Square Garden, if I can get a good connection, because sometimes with this iPhone, in some of these buildings, there's no connection, or there may be a great connection. For all I know, I may have no service inside the garden for the pay-per-view. But if I do, I may do some live tweeting during the show. Maybe I'll post some pictures of the SE Scoops crew at the garden. So you'll want to follow me on Twitter for that. Facebook.com/TheSolomonster is my address on there. Friend me on there. You can search for the show and subscribe to it in iTunes. If you type in Solomonster Sounds Off, you can also leave a review for the show. I would very much appreciate that. If you do leave a review, email me and let me know. I'll give you a shout-out here on this very podcast. And you can subscribe to my YouTube channel. My YouTube username is TheSolomonster. All one word. There's no space. There's no underscore. There's no hyphen. And I've been posting more and more on YouTube. In fact, I may post this show on YouTube as well. I haven't decided yet. But If you are a YouTube subscriber, you'll know whenever any new content goes up there. So definitely subscribe, leave comments, and all that good stuff. As always, I really appreciate all of your support. I hope very much that if you are watching the Survivor Series this weekend, wherever you may be, I know some of you will be at Madison Square Garden along with me. I do hope wherever you are that you do enjoy the show. Let's hope WWE does not let us down as they have so many times before, because I think they have a golden opportunity to do something exciting this weekend. So let's hope it lives up to expectations. And on episode 192, I will have a full rundown, a full live perspective of being at the Survivor Series in Madison Square Garden, so that's something to look forward to. As far as the next show is concerned, I'm not exactly sure when it's going to be, if it'll be in the normal slot next weekend, or if I may do it even a day or two earlier, because I, as many of you here in the States, will have a couple of days off for the Thanksgiving holiday. And by the way, since I won't be doing a show before Thanksgiving, I want to wish a very happy Thanksgiving to everybody celebrating here in this country. I hope you have some good times with family and get a couple of days off from work, which is always my favorite part of the holiday. So it's possible I could do a show a little bit earlier, or I may just do it, you know, the normal time over the weekend next week. I haven't figured that out yet, but you know, keep it locked into Twitter, Facebook, and all that stuff, and I'll keep you guys posted. So until next time, be well, stay safe, enjoy the Survivor Series. We'll see you right back here next time for the Solomonster Sounds Off on SEScoops.com.
Let me tell you something, fella.
This is Joel from Northern Ireland.
Hi, I'm AJ Grimaldo.
And quite simply, the fastest 60 minutes on the internet.
The Solomonster Sounds Off on SEScoops.com.